How many times has this happened to you? You said, what I need is a great podcast on books. Well, it's here. Chatter on Books, and it starts right now. I'm Jamie McIntyre, your part-time announcer, and here's your full-time host, Tori Clark.
Okay, wait, I've got to get my notes. Happy New Year, everybody. It is so great to be back with Chatter. We've been off for a few weeks, so I've missed everybody. Hope everyone is doing well. We have a really good author this evening, Chip Reed, who's longtime journalist, known for a long time. He, NBC, among other things, covered the Iraq Wars and a bunch of stuff. And he has this great book called Battle Scars. He was embedded at the beginning of the Iraq War back in 2003. And he went back 20 years later and has interviewed a bunch of these guys. They were, I think, almost exclusively guys. And it's really interesting. It's it was kind of interesting. I don't know about you, Jamie, but to go back down memory road. It was sad. It was inspirational. It was a lot of things. But we got him. In the meantime, we got Claude doing the important work. We've got David looking very natty in a sports coat. Did you get the whole quarter zip thing going on there, David?
Well, yeah, sort of.
That's
so
nice.
It's been a fashion trend as of late to wear hoodies under your sports coat, but David's bringing in the quarter zip. I think he's starting a new trend here.
Yeah, I like
the way that looks. Yeah, man.
Do hoodies. You know, I'm working. That's not my clothes.
The quarter zip under the sports jacket looks very nice.
Yeah, I like that.
We've got Jamie coming from a dark, secluded, unidentified place.
It's the Batcave. Yes.
And you're wearing your Steve Jobs crew neck black something or other.
Yeah, you always say that, but it's just a black t-shirt.
Okay. So for people in the know, I often send out, usually on Thursday before a show, kind of a rundown of what we might cover in the show. And I always have things at the top about book news or whatever. I may have to throw it all out because two things I want to talk about. And David, one to you, the most winningest coach ever, NCAA, Tara Vanderveer.
Yes.
Pretty spectacular.
Oh, sure. I mean, she's great. I mean,
more than Coach K.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what I like about Tara Vanderveer and have liked for many years is that she doesn't point to herself and say, look at me, look at me, look at me, look at me.
Yeah.
You know, look at all the great stuff. Look at my innovations. Look at all the pros I sent to the WNBA. Look at all the, which she could very well do because her record's impeccable. She's won national championships. She's a great coach.
She's won a gold medal. She coached a gold medal.
Yeah. If you have a chance, I highly recommend ESPN's 30 for 30 on the women's dream team, basically, in 1996. That was in Atlanta, and she coached that team. I mean, it's 3 hours, but it goes by like nothing because it's so well done. Cool. Just about how demanding she was and just how she – demanded perfection and they gave it to her. You know what I mean? Like it was incredible. And so, yeah, I'm happy for her because she reads, she takes the summer off and goes to a lake and just paddles boats and just thinks about stuff. And that's, I like people like that. Yeah. So good for her.
I've seen a couple of the interviews lately and obviously I knew of her, but had never really watched much, but seen a couple of interviews. And to your point, all she says, no, it's just about hard work and what's the next play and what's the next play and what do we need to learn from that one? And just very businesslike and very straightforward. Love that.
And that's what, you know, I grew up when I started covering the NBA, Jerry Sloan was the coach in Utah News. And he said, look, all I can do is try to get them to do some things. And then if they do them, they do. And if they don't, they don't. There's not, doesn't mean they're bad players or I'm a bad coach. And when you think about that, it's like, that's true. The ball goes in or it doesn't. Like, it doesn't, you know, like, it's not, we're not building bridges here or sending someone to the moon. I mean, it's basketball. Ball goes in the basket or it doesn't. So
okay, but isn't it a little different for a coach of a college team than NBA?
Sure.
Little bit more of getting them to work together, those kinds of things.
Sure, because the players change because they're only there 4 years most of the time, and some of them leave much earlier, at least mostly in the men's game. But, you know, so sure, it's much different and much harder in the college game.
All right. Well, we're very happy for her. Congratulations. Yes. Then again, several other things I was going to talk about, and I happened, this is a real news, pieces of a real newspaper, the New York Times, reading this morning, and I'm not sure why they put this in the back of the business section of the New York Times, but it's about Beatrix Potter. It's not like it was her birthday or whatever, but it turns out Beatrix Potter, she of The Tale of Peter Rabbit, self-published. And this piece is by Jess Bidgood, which is a perfect name for someone writing about Beatrix Potter. Jess Bidgood. And says, among other things, the year was 1900, and Potter, then in her mid-30s, had submitted her book, The Tale of Peter Rabbit, complete with her own intricate illustrations, to at least six publishers, all rejected, and she got frustrated. She was writing to friends and family how frustrated she was. She finally decided to print it herself. The next September, she took her savings to a private printer in London and ordered 250 copies of the book, which she distributed herself. Demand was so great, she printed more, etc. Arthur Conan Doyle was a big fan. Finally, in 1902, so 2 years later, a publishing company decided to release Peter Rabbit to a wider audience. Long story short, 45 million copies later. 45 million copies of this book. And among other things she did, when it started to become really popular, this woman was so ahead of time. She designed a Peter Rabbit doll, injecting the legs with lead to help it stand up, and registered it as patent number 423888. Then there were figurines, wallpaper, and more dolls. So she knew how to market. First of all, she self-published, and she knew marketing, which is spectacular. So there's that. Okay. Nobody's as impressed with Beatrix Potter as I am, but I think
We have all the Beatrix Potter books, but my favorite one is an obscure one, which is The Tale of the Fierce Bad Rabbit. Have you ever read The Tale of the Fierce Bad
great.
Rabbit?
No.
You know that it goes about halfway through. This is a bad rabbit. And about halfway through the book,
those are my people, Bad Bunny.
A hunter appears with a shotgun. And then, you know, it's going to go bad from there.
Not going to end well.
It's one of the darker Beatrix Potter books.
But that just sounds like Peter Rabbit on steroids. Peter Rabbit gets in trouble with a gardener who wants to hurt
him.
Right,
but Mr. McGregor doesn't actually blast Peter to smither bits.
No, but he's going to walk him with that rake.
You should, man. I tell you, Tale of the Fierce Bad Rabbit.
Is it a sequel?
It's the best one of the series.
Okay. Email. So y'all remember Purist Bond, Jen Golbeck and Stacey Covina, the great cover with the great golden retriever on the cover. It's about the human, whatever. We got more emails about that book than anything else. And people shared stories about their dogs. And we got a really lovely one from Jim. I don't want to use his last name because I'm not sure if he wanted me to. But Jim sent an email and he says, you know, he included a picture of Togo, really cute, yellow, lavish looking dog. Says, Togo is a rescue and was a breeding dog in one of those horrible puppy mills. Sweetest dog I've ever had. Thank you for Chatter on Books. It has kindled my interest in reading more. But got a couple dozen emails on that book. And others we get maybe two or three, to be perfectly honest. So it touched somebody.
Doggos. Okay. Everybody loves kisses.
Yeah. Before I'm dead, David Aldridge and Claude will have dogs.
I keep telling you, this is not about
I know. They're hypoallergenic. Okay.
I don't like your dogs.
I'm a cat person. I still think cats are your best entertainment value, but I do recognize that there are things dogs can do that cats can't. And I bring to mind a couple of recent news stories. One was the dog up in Michigan. Did you read about him that saved his owner by taking the rescue line to him and bringing it back across the ice?
David and Todd, did you see this?
I did not, no.
Spectacular. Jamie, go ahead. And
yeah,
the dog
Rudy,
Ruby.
It's like the dog's name, Ruby. Ruby the rescue dog. Yeah. And then, of course, there was the story of Cecil, who ate $4,000 in cash that his owners had taken out to put a new fence in, resulting in both them taping bills back together and also going on a patrol in the backyard to
a rough day.
Extract
it's a bad
the
day.
Remnants from there. Because if you have more than 50% of the bill with the serial number and you send it to the Treasury, they'll give you a new bill. But you have to have the pieces.
And do you have to clean the pieces? Would you have to wash those? And
yeah, they had to launder the money. They were money laundering.
Essentially.
I was all over Ruby the rescue dog, but that second one, I heard about that as well. And I thought to myself, who's got $4,000 in cash sitting around?
Well, apparently the fence contractor wanted cash. You've dealt with contractors before.
Yeah, we're not paying them cash. We're paying them our retirement.
Defense, it's the same thing.
Anyway, my point is that dogs have unique capabilities that cats don't, even though I'm kind of a cat person.
Okay, that cat never would have gone out to the ice and saved its owner.
No.
You remember the cat couldn't care less. No.
You recall the famous, I think, Christopher Hitchens quote about the difference between dogs and cats? Do you remember this quote?
No,
I do not.
I'm not going to get it exactly right, but it's if you provide food and water and shelter and affection to a dog, the dog will think you're God. And if you provide food, water, affection and shelter to a cat, they think they're God. Basically, like the difference.
My favorite is, and I've now stolen it as mine, but I used to give Jeanette Black, Louis Black's mother, God rest her soul, I used to give her credit for this. She raised two sons, and she used to say that in her next life, instead of kids, she's going to have dogs. She says, because they're always happy to see you and they're easier to train.
Yes.
Our dog Boo, the red lab, she stays downstairs. Every morning you come down and she greets you like it's the best day of her life and she cannot wait to get on with it for you. It's spectacular.
As my friend Richard Justice used to say, every day is their first day.
You know, there's nothing wrong with that.
No. Okay.
All right. Also sent in by alert listener Jamie McIntyre. How many books did you read in 2023? Kind of an interesting question for us on this show. David, do you know?
I couldn't even hazard a guess. It's in the double digits, not in the triple digits, so to say that.
Yeah, I think you're in the high double digits. Claude, how many books did you read? You're too busy to read books.
There, I think, however, there's looking through my little device now. I listened to about six last year.
That counts. Listening counts.
Yeah, I listened to six.
Yeah. Jamie McIntyre, how many did you read in 2023?
Well, I just want to say, first of all, that the way I became aware of this statistic is my wife turned to me one day and she said, how many books do you think you have to read in order to be ahead of half the people in the country? And I said, I don't know, one.
And that's she said, it's got to be at least like one or
it's
two.
It's higher
two,
than
right?
one. So then I said, three. And she said, four. No, lower than three. And then I drew a blank. I couldn't figure out what so that's how I became aware of it. I don't know exactly how many, but I know it was more than one and probably more than three. But it depends on whether you count. Do you have to finish the book?
No. Nope.
Because I've read large subsections of books that I haven't finished, especially nonfiction ones where I don't feel like I have to finish because, for instance, in Chip's book, I actually know how it all turns out in the end, but with the 2003 invasion of Iraq. But as he points out, actually, in the beginning of the book, of his book, he says, it's not chronological. You can just dip in and out for different stories at different places. And a lot of times that's how I read a book.
But a really good book, I would argue, fiction or nonfiction. A really good book, you should be able to do that. I mean, think about it. You could pick up any book by Hemingway and pick any page and go, love that line, right?
I think a really good book, you should be able to do that.
So did I effectively dodge the question? Because
both of you, David's definitely in the high double digits.
No, I don't know. I wouldn't say it's high double digits, but it's double digits. It's not
that number,
nine.
By the way, of the average American reads about, it says 12.6 books a year, according to Word
Rated. Well,
it was
more than that, but it's not 98 either. So I'm not going to lie.
What's the percentage of Americans who didn't read a single book in 2020?
Let me check that out. Let me see.
I think that's a lot.
I think it's like 40 somethings.
Most have not. Okay.
It's way more than 40.
Okay. Yeah. Then different people, when this story appeared, everybody else started jumping in, and there's some outfit called, it was an economist YouGov poll that started the whole thing, reading habits, et cetera. And then this outfit called Department of Data, which is just who knows what, Andrew Van Dam, don't know who he is. A 1,500 Americans surveyed, a less than ideal 40% finished zero books last year, and 5% read just one. So if you read more than two books in 2023, you're in the top half of U.S. adults.
I'm surprised. I thought it'd be higher than that. So good. Yay, us.
I'm proud of my.
I thought it was going to be like 65-70% didn't read a book if my children are.
Yeah. I think this is, I mean, you never know who they ask, but yeah, nobody under 40 reads books anymore.
Right. That's my point.
Well, yeah, if they counted books I read to my granddaughter, I'm way up.
Oh, there's a whole, there were many offshoots that, you know, reading Goodnight Moon to your grandchildren 18 times does not count.
Right. You don't get 18 credits for that? All right.
Okay, here's
a fun Wheels on the Bus. That was the one that was.
There you go.
This continuing story. How many books do you own? Claude, how many books in your house? Of all kinds.
So that number is probably in the hundreds because I do a lot of work in media. So I get books sent to me all the time and I'll pick some up. I'll read through like half of them to prepare for interviews and stuff like that. But I've got a ton of them, a ton of books. I'm trying to get rid of a lot of them. Actually,
that's a good solid number.
Yeah, put me down for a ton.
I know I have over 1,000, could be several thousand. We have so many books that every time a house goes on the market in our neighborhood, we look at each other and seriously think about, could we just buy that house to put the books in? You know, it's right. It's just down the street. We have books stacked everywhere. All of our bookshelves are full. We bought more bookshelves. We need more. We have bookshelves for our bookshelves. We have so many books.
Okay, how about this? What percentage of the books that you have you read from cover to cover?
Well, less than a ton for me.
Being an old person, many, I would say over 50% of the books I have in my bookshelves that go wall to wall in the basement, I've read cover to cover. I don't remember them. A lot of them I read in the, you know, 70s and 80s, but I still have them.
Yeah.
Absolutely. The dulcet tones of Chip Reed. Hi, Chip. How are you?
How are you?
Good. All right. We'll come right back to you. David, how many books do you own?
Oh, hundreds. I mean, but, you know, between me and Diane and I, it's hundreds. Yeah. I mean, you know,
it's probably over 1,000.
Yeah.
We have a lot less than we used to. We used to have a lot in the thousands.
You give books away?
We made the move from the house in Chevy Chase to, well, we have nowhere to live now. I really embraced my inner Marie Kondo and said, I have got to give some of these away. But two things. One, I found myself going through every single one of them. And with very few exceptions, I had read them and they all meant something. But here's the important reason I went through every single book. Remember Y2K?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right? And we thought everything was going to close. And then there was some other stuff, you know, and the waking up. Long story short, I was convinced that something terrible was going to happen. And we wouldn't be able to access ATMs and, you know, the economy would collapse and you'd have to pay cash for stuff. So
I can see where this is going.
His head and laughing. And so I started just, you know, randomly putting $50, $60 in different books. Can't put a number on it, but it was more than 20. Well, I couldn't stick it under the mattress, so I stuck this cash all over in these books. And I swear to God, so we gave books away to AmVets. We gave all sorts of different places. So I hope as people read some book and found $50 or $60, they were happy. But a lot of cash. Chip Reed, how many books do you own?
I'd say probably in the vicinity of 1,000, but that's my wife and me together. But I would say we have given away many books over the years to libraries and to charitable organizations that the books are relevant to.
I always want to put books in those little free libraries that you see in all the neighborhoods.
Yeah. Yeah. We have one right across the street from our house. Yeah.
They're always filled.
We've done that, but we also have a used bookstore in our neighborhood up here in Gaithersburg. Uh-huh. And I used to take the books in a box and they'd say, you know, they would take the ones that they could sell. And then, you know, and they would give me a small amount of money I could spend in the bookstore, which then of course defeats the whole purpose because I would go and pick up a couple of more books and take them home. But I've gotten to the point now where I don't want anything for them. I just want them to take them.
Yeah. It gets harder.
I just take the book and just like whatever you want, take whatever you can't use, recycle, whatever you do with them. I just need them gone.
Because of the pandemic, and it was true about old furniture and stuff like that too. This is now chatter on random topics.
better on clutter.
So many people were decluttering their homes during the pandemic that these places got filled up and said no more furniture, no more books, those kinds of things. Okay, Chip Reed, I know you know Jamie McIntyre. Do you know David Aldridge and Claude Jennings? If not,
it's wonderful to meet them.
There we go.
I certainly know of them.
Great. It's so good to see you. First and foremost, how the heck do you know Jamie Sterling? Jamie Sterling's a dear friend of mine that got me.
We met in prison.
Yeah. Which one?
Rikers Island.
I spent
a lot of time in Rikers Island, actually. But when I was in law school, I was representing people in Rikers Island. So it's but Jamie and I know each other. We live about a 1 minute walk from each other. That's probably how we know each other. And I think, well, actually, we knew him. I met him at the same bar where I met my wife, Cafe Deluxe.
Wow, the one up on Wisconsin Avenue.
Yeah, that doesn't exist anymore. Yeah.
That was Jamie Sterling.
And it's right across from the National Cathedral. So in a pinch, you know, if I'm meeting conservative friends of family or something, I can say, well, we kind of met in church. So.
And if I was at Cafe Deluxe, I was no doubt with my pal who lives across the street from Cafe Deluxe, Chris Plant, who used to be my producer at the Pentagon. I remember is that I knew Chip before he was such a big deal.
When did he become a big deal?
He was just a common man, a simple, humble man.
I'm still simple.
And then he became a big, I think it was before you were at NBC. I can't remember exactly when.
I was a lawyer for 6 years before we got into local news. And then I did local news and then network. And now I have my best job ever where I'm the boss. So
excellent. Okay. So many people know you, Chip, from your life on TV and your terrific work in journalism for so many years. But how does one, how did you first go into law and then how did you make the transition to journalism?
Well, I went to law, but I wanted to be a civil rights lawyer or a human rights lawyer.
And, Why?
Because in law school, the most powerful thing I ever read was Brown versus Board of Education. And I was just so impressed and inspired by that, that I decided then and there I was going to go to law school and be a civil rights lawyer. And so to avoid the temptation of money that law firms, pose. I never interviewed with law firms while I was in law school, and I had two job offers when I got out. One was with an obscure senator from Delaware named Joe. I don't know whatever happened to him be his civil rights lawyer on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and the other was with a small civil rights group in North Carolina, where I would have gone from town to town suing towns for discriminating against their against their black populations in the provision of municipal services. I often wish I had done that and gotten down in the trenches for a couple of years. But here was this job with the top Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and straight out of law school, I was an expert on constitutional law and civil rights law. And so I did that for 4 years. And then I ended up going to his first presidential campaign. And when it went down in a ball of flames, as you may recall, in 1987, I decided I had to do something else. I had become a Nightline junkie, and I wanted to get into the news business. So I got it took me 6 months. I was down to my last jar of peanut butter, and I got a part-time offer at ABC News, and that was my foot in the door.
Wow. Who was your first boss at ABC? Do you remember?
George Watson was the bureau chief, and he's the guy who hired me, and the various other bosses there was Pat and there was Dean Norland, Pat, whose last name I can't remember. If he's watching, he'll kill me. But it was great. I worked a lot with Britt Hume and Sam Donaldson. First time I did an interview, I went out and I interviewed Mike Deaver the day that his conviction was overturned, and it was about 6:15. The news comes on at 6:30. A motorcycle roared up. I ran out, hand him the tape. He rushed off. I go back to the bureau. We get back there at 6:31, and I look up, and there is my interview, the back of my head that I just did with Mike Deaver. And I thought, this is the coolest thing I have ever done in my life. And I was hooked on the news business right then and there. The immediacy of it, which of course is even greater now. So it was incredible.
It's more immediate. I don't know if it's as exciting. David, you can speak.
No,
David,
it's not.
Well, all three of you guys can speak to this. David, is it, you still do breaking stuff. You still cover a big, game or something like that. But is it as exciting? Is it that breathtaking?
No.
God, we got it.
There's a lot of, as Chip described, you know, this, we had all these deadlines and they had to, they were, you know, they were immutable. They could not be moved.
Right.
You know, that scene in broadcast news where they run the tape cassette and,
yeah,
you know,
she almost runs into the filing cabinet. Yes.
I cannot tell you how many times I witnessed that scene when I was at CNN, where the anchor on the air is reading the intro into the piece, which has just been popped out of the edit deck. And as they're reading it, they pop it in. It's just, I saw that so many times. I don't know if it's still that way today with all the electronic stuff, but I imagine, cause everything's on servers now and,
it is that way because TV news reporters tend to be procrastinators and they drive their producers crazy. So yes, it will always be that way. Yes.
But nobody needs to go running and, you know, no messenger needs to go flying across town on a bicycle.
No, I don't know. I don't know. I did some running. I did some running. There were live shots I did where I stood in front of the camera 1 second before on the air and I was huffing and puffing. So yeah, it still happens.
Still happens. Okay. Should we talk about your fabulous book, Battle Scars?
Why not?
Because I think this is important. So this was 21 years ago, right? Battle Scars, holding it up.
20 years ago.
20 years ago.
2003. Oh, yeah. Yes. Wow. You're right. It's almost 21. Wow.
Almost 21. So, almost 21. But what made you think that embedding with any of the military that would go into a war in Iraq, what made you think that was a good idea? What drove you? What made you go, I got to do that? Because you look like you're 25 now, but you were not a spring chicken.
I was 48. I was 48, and the, you know, the Marines I was working with were old enough to be my son. But if you just think in terms of biology, many of them were young enough to be my grandson.
Yeah.
So it's actually, I'll try to do this real quickly. But when after 9/11 happened, I was based in Los Angeles at the time. So they said, you need to get back here. And nobody cared about California or West Coast news at that point. So I came back. It took me days to get back, planes, trains, and automobiles. And I came back and covered 9/11 for in the pit, right by the pit for 2 weeks. I'm very lucky I did not have any adverse consequences from that. Then to the Pentagon for a week to do constant reporting from there. This was at NBC at the time. So it was live shot, live shot, live shot, live shot. And then they sent me to Cairo, Egypt. And while I was there, to be the listening post in the Arab world. And so while I was there, they called me and said, we're sending our first group of people into Afghanistan because clearly a war is going to happen there. Do you want to go? And I freaked out didn't freak out. But I just thought, Jesus, do I want to do that? I've never covered a war. So I said, can I talk to my then girlfriend about it? And Nina, who's now my wife. And they said, sure. And I called back in the morning and I said, yes, I want to do it. And they said, too late. Somebody else got your slot. So 2 years or so later, when it was clear that there was going to be a war in Iraq, I started, I was so embarrassed that I didn't have the courage to just say yes right away, because that's what we do as journalists. When there's a building on fire, you run to it. When everybody else is running away, that's what you do. And so I started emailing them. I don't know if we had email then. We had some kind of computer system. But I started notifying them early on that I wanted to be part of it and I wanted to be as close to the action as possible. And that's what I got. Thank you to you, Tori. Thank you, Tori, because this was the story of my 33 years in news.
You know,
head and shoulders.
You're nice to say that. It was a cast of thousands that made that happen. But it was an interesting. So many people have said, oh, you know, thanks to the Pentagon for letting me go. And I've talked to many reporters over the years. We decided on the program, but we emphatically said to the networks, to the newspapers, to the wire services, everybody, we emphatically said to them, you have to decide who you send. We're not going to make that decision for you. And it makes me thinking about Ted Koppel, and I can't remember his producer's name, but I can see him. He's with them for a thousand years.
Yeah.
Ted Koppel wanted to embed, and he's calling me, and they're stopping by the Pentagon, and they have people calling. I kept saying, not my call, not our call. We will not decide that. for your network. And so then to impress upon ABC how much they wanted to do it, he and his producer started working out. And this must have been February.
No kidding.
February.
Wow.
They started working out and they would send pictures and videos of themselves. They put on, they didn't carry 65 pounds like, you know, somebody else might, but they were carrying yeah. weight and they were sending the pictures and the images all the time to convince people. And I kept saying, not my call, but you went through kind of a military boot camp, right?
Yep. 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 We went out to the Shenandoah along the Shenandoah River in the mountains there and spent a week there. And then they called us early. We went earlier than we had thought, and we thought, oh my gosh, this war is more imminent than we had thought. And when we got there, they made it clear to us the reason was not that it was more imminent. It was because they needed to put us through some more training, and mostly medical training, a lot of first aid, a lot of learning about the various drugs that you would take if you were victimized by chemical weapons or whatever else, a lot of learning from. And believe it or not, you know, I had General Sam Mundy, I mean, Lieutenant Colonel then Sam Mundy, and right above him was Joe Dunford, who became Commandant and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And above him was Jim Mattis. Yeah. And those are the guys, Mattis and Dunford, who gave us our pep talks before we went. And we had, you know, no idea they were going to become the superstars that they were. But I remember Mattis saying at the end of his pep talk, he said, if you're crazy enough to be here, you're welcome here.
Yeah.
And it was a great feeling. I can't say I was really that nervous. I was eager. I was really in a state of nervous anticipation. I wanted to do this. And, you know, the Marines kept hearing rumors that, oh, you know, it might not happen. And I didn't believe that for a second. And I was very eager for it to happen. I wanted to see this. I had covered every kind of story in the world except war. And I, you know, I wasn't happy about the war. I didn't think it was a smart war even then. But I wanted, as long as there were troops in it and there was a story going on, I wanted to be there and be part of it.
Jamie, ever tempted?
No.
No.
So there's a part in your book, Chip, where you say something about you tell your wife or to be, that, you know, this is what you have to do because you're a journalist.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I appreciate that. I really do. And but I have to say, I was not tempted to want to go. You know, I had two kids and a wife and an $8 million insurance policy. So if I died, I would be able to get an $8 million, which cost an arm and a leg, by the way. and I did go to a lot of these places, but usually after the shooting was over when it was safe. But I was never tempted to be part of it. I used to tell people I'm a Pentagon correspondent. I'm not a war correspondent, which is probably, by the way, why I haven't really written a memoir about it, because the tales of the travails of getting more paper for the printer and finding a spot in the Pentagon press parking lot isn't quite as riveting.
Oh, I don't know. I've seen small wars break out over that. So
exactly. David Aldrich, ever tempted to do something like that?
No.
I mean, you've been sports born and raised, and that was clearly where you were always going to go. But were you ever tempted? You're at the Washington Post and you're watching people run around and do other. Were you ever tempted to another part of journalism covering something?
Sure. Oh, I still would love to cover a presidential campaign someday. I'm running out of days, but
yeah.
Oh,
go ahead.
I never more.
No, I would have gone. But I would have gone and I would have, you know. But I didn't volunteer and I didn't lobby for it, and I was perfectly happy to cover the war from the Pentagon and watch our excellent war correspondents over there.
Yeah.
Go through all the stuff they went through, which Chip went through as well.
Yeah. And as Chip talks about the military, it's interesting, the further away you get from that, you kind of remember the big things. No surprise, the lawyers at the Pentagon hated the entire idea of embedding hundreds and hundreds of journalists, 99% of whom had zero combat experience. You were in good company there, Chip. They had zero
interest. Mr. Magoo goes to war.
Yeah, they just fought it tooth and nail, tooth and nail, tooth and nail.
And then we
came up with the idea of the military boot camp, saying at least they'll get the fundamentals and elementary whatever. And they hated that idea, too. They said that just makes us more liable, but hated it. Beginning, middle and end. Hated it. Okay.
Way too many lawyers. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay. So let's talk about, tell the story about your inspiration for writing this book. Thanksgiving 2021, was it?
It's 2021. That's right. Thanksgiving 2021. Very good. I was driving home to Delaware to pick up from DC to Delaware to pick up my mother and then take her up to Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, to my brother's house for Thanksgiving dinner, which we did every year. Just a little side note here. I can't mention my mother without saying we put her in hospice care today. So it's,
Oh, I'm sorry.
but it's, no, it's been a long time coming. I'm psychologically prepared for it, and I've been doing all the work because my brothers are doctors and they're busy all the time, and I'm a gallivanting retiree, so I have the time to do all this. But anyway, I was driving home to pick her up and go to Thanksgiving dinner, and a pickup truck, a big tricked out pickup truck, roared by me in the left-hand lane, doing some ridiculous speed, and it had temporary plates and two Marine stickers, one on the back window and one on the bumper. And I'm sure it by today it probably has 20. And as it drove by, I thought, isn't that just like a Marine? He just bought the damn thing and he's already plastering it with Marine Corps stickers. And that got me thinking about my time in Iraq. And I had been spending a lot of my time thinking, okay, now that I'm not working anymore, I need to write that book I've been talking about all my life. But I had always thought it would be about politics because that's most of what I covered. The last thing I wanted to do was write a book about the downward spiral of politics in recent years, which so many people had done. And what could I add to that? So at this truck, I just had a eureka moment. There was literally, I think that there actually there was a light above my head. It was the car light above my head, and I thought, "That's it. I'm going to write a book about the most amazing story I covered in 33 years as a journalist, and that was being embedded with the U.S. Marines. I had tremendous admiration for these guys, and I could hardly wait to tell their stories. And I started formulating my questions right then and there. I called a general, just retired Lieutenant General Sam Mundy when I got back home, and he said it's a great idea. They trust you because their families loved you because you were on the air all the time talking about them and about their guys, and it was all guys, as you know, it was all men in the frontline Marine battalions at the time. Not so anymore, as I understand it, but it was a eureka moment, and I knew right then and there, that's what I was going to do. I had an agent who tried to talk me into just interviewing three or four and making it a deep dive on each of them and getting into every aspect of their life. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to give a platform for as many of these guys as I could because they wanted to tell their stories. So that's what I did. It's basically, the only other book I know like this where you interview a whole bunch of people about a war was Ted Koppel's, Tom Brokaw's book, The Greatest Generation. His will sell, has sold a whole lot more copies than I expect mine to sell. But this is a book that was in me and it had to come out.
Yeah, when he did that book, it was interesting. I read that. You're talking about that, and I thought, wow, it was kind of shocking that someone hadn't done The Greatest Generation already. And then Tom Brokaw's book and his focus on them spawned a lot of other things. And then when Jamie first told me about you're working on this book, I thought, wow, I'm surprised nobody's done that, gone back and talked to some of these people, because it was a incredible experience for you being embedded with these. They were all young Marines. It was also an incredible experience with them. And really, when I look back on it, the military, from the most senior officers to the lowest rank, wanted people to tell their stories. They wanted
Yeah,
people
absolutely.
what they did,
Absolutely.
how they did it, how they performed under pressure. They were the biggest support. There were several times, including the first 3 days, when very senior people wanted to shut the whole thing down, and they were the ones who said, "No, this is good." Does anybody remember? I'll see if Jamie remembers the Geraldo Rivera story. Some
Oh,
had
where he drew a
Geraldo.
map in the sand? Is that
Yep.
the one?
So there were very few. This is kind of inside baseball, but it's important. There were very few. We had very simple guidelines for the whole thing, and simply said, don't reveal information about location, tactics, et cetera. But it's pretty straightforward, and 99% of the people abided by it. And Geraldo was embedded, I think, maybe with 101st. I can't remember. But whoever, anyway, somebody comes running to my office and says, we got a problem. Geraldo Rivera's doing a live shot this morning from wherever they were, and he, in a live shot, drew a picture. He said where they were, where they were going, and drew a picture in the sand with a diagram to point where they were going. And they said, based on the guidelines and whatever, he needs to get thrown out. And I said, it's the call of whoever the commanding officer was. I said, it's his call. He's got to do it. And so that person calls up and says, okay, we're going to throw him out, but we want him back. I said, sure, why? And said, because everybody loves having them, and the troops love that their friends, their family, their loved ones, everyone knew what they were doing. That was our greatest support game.
Wow. Well, you know who replaced me was Ollie North at some point. And, they liked me, but they loved him.
Yeah, so. They loved Ollie. Okay, tell us a little bit about the 3-5.
3-5 is just, it was meeting these guys was one of the most amazing experiences of my life. Because as I say in the book, when I was 18 years old, my biggest problem was whether to invite my good friend Willa Fisher to the senior prom, because I didn't have a girlfriend at the time, or her smoking hot little 15-year-old sister, Wanda. And that was more dangerous than actually embedding with the Marines. And so But that's the kind of problem I had. And these guys at age 18, 19, 20 were making life and death decisions in an instant. And they were eager to get out there and do it. Yeah, they were nervous. But it was I just came to admire these guys right away. And I really enjoyed it.
They looked out for
Pardon
you.
Me?
Right? It was not part of their mission. It was not they were not expected to do it, but they looked out for you.
They did look out for me. There was one in particular, Bill Rodriguez, who often drove the vehicle I was in. And you know, we were told by Mattis that these guys are not going to be able to take care of you. You need to take care of yourselves. You need to stay out of their way and stay out of the line of fire. And the first time we did come under fire, Bill grabbed me and shoved me. He was 20 and I was 48 and shoved me under a truck and said, stay there. Well, I didn't get stay. No, into a truck and said, stay there. And I crept out as soon as he was out of sight, because you can't cover a story from inside the back of a 7-ton truck. But still, they were watching out for me. There was another time when I crept up too high from the ditch we were in to do a stand up with the cameraman who was down safe down there. And I stood up so that my helmet was slightly above the level where it should be. And am I allowed to use the F word on this?
Absolutely. It's a podcast.
Okay, because that word is used about 10,000 times. As soon as my helmet got about 3 inches above where it should be with snipers shooting at us, a chorus of Marines said, get the fuck down. And I just hit my... And that's the kind of thing they did. They did.
What the Marines were yelling at you to get your head down, that kind of worked to lose your video. That was perfect.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I planned that. I had planned that. And they did. They took care of me. They really did. They watched out for me. At first, some of them didn't trust me. They thought I was there looking for them doing bad things, which, of course, I was not doing. No. Let me give you the one story that shows you how free we were to report. I'll give the very short version, but there's a lot in the book about this. There was a dark night, chaos, right after a sandstorm and a big rainstorm, and they were getting reports over their radio that there were Iraqi troops advancing. I don't know if there were, but anyway. So somebody fired, they thought they saw something, and the whole group of the Marines near me opened up, and in the morning they went out and discovered they had killed two little girls. They believed they were being used as human shields, but we'll never know. So my producer and I, actually John Zito, the producer, found these guys. He found four or five guys who had been part of the group that shot in that direction. And they were absolutely beside themselves they were horrified at what they had done, but they believed it wasn't their fault. And I don't think it was. It's war. There was horrible stuff going on. They believed that they were being closed in on by Iraqi troops. So I, just to be on the good side with Lieutenant Colonel Mundy, went to him and said, we're going to put this story on the air tonight. And he said, oh boy, wow. He said, let me go run it up the chain of command. So he went probably to Dunford, and that probably went to Mattis, and maybe even to the Pentagon. I don't know. And he came back very quickly afterward and said, I've been read the Riot Act. You guys are free to report on anything other than where we're going.
Right.
And tactics and how many people are in a particular unit. And of course, the other thing is that if anybody is injured, badly injured or killed, you cannot report it until the family has been notified. That was the number one thing they were concerned with, that more than they were concerned with with giving where they were going next. Yeah. But that was the big one. And they said, go ahead. So I did that story. I interviewed these four or five guys. We put the story on the air. It did not cause a sensation, I think, because so much else was going on. If that had happened during a quiet period, that was very early in the war, and it might have caused a sensation if it happened later. But these guys wanted to tell the story because they wanted to explain to people back home that they did not believe it was their fault. They wanted to get it off their chest.
Well, and there was, because of the access you had, this is going way back, but I do remember this as you're talking about, because of the access you all had, you could provide something that often is missing in real-time
right.
coverage, and that is you could provide the context. You
That's
could,
right. That's right. That's right. And I provided all that context in the story to understand how difficult it is in war when you literally, with night vision goggles on, they could see nothing. It was so dark and dusty that night. Only with heat-seeking goggles could they see anything. And whoever it was thought they saw Iraqis coming our direction. It was probably a family of people running from grandma's house to mom's house or something like that.
So 20 years later, you get the idea for this fabulous book, Battle Scars. What was it like reaching out to them? Were they eager to talk to you? Was it sad? Was it wonderful to reconnect with someone?
It was like I was being received at a homecoming. It was, wow. We would love to tell our stories. Mm-hmm. My guess is a lot of the guys who I interviewed, and, you know, there's a lot of PTSD here, but also a lot of PTG, post-traumatic growth, which is a concept I really wanted to educate people about, which I did in this book. But some of the guys who talked to me had gone through hell with PTSD or PTS. A lot of them don't like that D on the end, that disorder brand. They feel like they've been branded. But a lot of these guys, I think, were the ones who had had their success story. They had gone through that long, dark tunnel. They had reached PTG at the other end. That's the light at the end of the tunnel. There were several guys who just said, you know, Chip, I would love to do this, but I'm not ready. 18, 19 years, and they weren't ready. That's what they had gone through. And that's how serious the stress, the post-traumatic stress is, that they just didn't want to dig it up again. And I've had some guys tell me, I read it 10 minutes at a time because I had to stop and cry after 10 minutes of reading certain sections of the book. So it is very powerful for the guys who were there, but I have received unanimous praise for writing it from the guys I interviewed. And that was the audience I was most concerned about. I could sell a million copies. I don't care.
But their families.
And I've had so many families say, wow, you told me so much more than I ever knew, because their guys opened up to me in ways that they sometimes hadn't even to their families.
I've got a million questions, but I'm hogging it. David, you first, and then Jamie, you.
Just curious about a couple of things. I have a good friend of mine who was an undercover cop for a long time and has worked in the PTS, what he calls development, not disorder, space. And he says one of the keys is always peer-to-peer is the first line of defense.
That's right.
Is the first way that these guys can kind of come out of this. And I wonder if you found that was the case as well. He did work in law enforcement. He wasn't.
Yeah. Law enforcement was very similar. Many of these guys went into law enforcement afterward, and that just added to the trauma they had already experienced. Several of these guys said, there was one in particular, it was decisive. He had not talked to any of his Marine friends in 15 years, I think it was, 16. And one of his best buddies in the Marines took his own life. And he drove from, I believe it was from Las Vegas to Los Angeles to get back with the boys, the guys he played cards with in Iraq. And he said life changing does not come close to explaining how big this was. He just felt like he was back with the people he loved, back with the people he needed. And when he got home, he did what his wife or girlfriend, I forget who it was, had been telling him for years, you need to get help. And he did. And he's 100% better today because he went and got professional help. And that's what they say. Yes, peer-to-peer is the first thing. But then your peers who have been through what have gone through getting help will tell you, you need to get help from a professional who has dealt with this. One guy had a great line. He went in after much resistance and finally went in to meet a psychiatrist who was an older petite woman. And he walked in, he said, I was in Cro-Magnon mode. And I said, what the fuck are you going to tell me about combat? And she said, I'm not going to tell you anything about combat. I'm going to tell you about how combat changed your brain. And he said she was absolutely right. And she did him a world of good and turned his life around with the addition of also talking to his military brothers and talking to the family. And many of these guys, when they get to a point, they're telling me stuff that I'm going, do you really want to be telling me this? I would say, are you okay going on with this? And they'd say, yeah, what I have learned is that talking even to you, to my family, to my fellow Marines, to my therapist, even to you, you know, even to random people on the street, talking about it is the best thing you can do, which always makes me so sad about all those World War II and Vietnam guys and, you know, soldiers and Marines for eons who have not talked about it, because what you have to do to be a soldier or Marine is be strong. You can't be whining and talking about your problems, but you need to. You need to.
Jamie, your turn.
Just a couple of quick observations. I mean, one of the things that strikes me about what you're talking about is, and this was my experience when I first came to the Pentagon, covered the Pentagon in 1992, and I started to go out and, you know, be with troops in the field, is we have a really young military, mm-hmm. and we entrust these young people with enormous responsibility. And one of the first things I did when I got to the Pentagon was go out and spend time on an aircraft carrier, the Theodore Roosevelt, which was in workups off the coast of North Carolina. And I'm watching these, you know, 18, 19-year-old kids landing these jets, doing these things where if they do anything wrong, something terrible is going to happen. And we have such trust in them. And I, you know, just recently, I, you know, witnessed how some people were really shocked that this, you remember the case of this young National Guard, Air Force National Guard airman in Massachusetts who was accused of leaking secrets. And they said, you know, how could somebody that young have any access to this stuff? And one of the things is we trust these young people to do these things. And then the other observation I would just make, and it's you've already made it, Chip, but I would just say is like the one thing that I took away from my years covering the military was war changes people. Nobody goes through what you went through and what the Marines that you were with went through without being changed in some way. You know, I saw that all the time. But the third thing I would just say is when they're operating together in a group, and if you ask a soldier, a sailor, airman, Marine, you know, now a guardian, you know, why they fight together, it's for the guy next to them or the
absolutely
that this
absolutely.
Time also the woman,
you know,
next
and-
to them.
And they like to say, everybody says, they're like brothers. No, they're more than brothers. They're more than brothers. I think there are lots of brothers in this world who would not put their lives on the line to save their birth brothers. But Marines will all put their lives on the line to save their Marine brothers. So many of these guys, when I said, what did you hesitate to shoot? And almost unanimously, they said, no, I never did, because if I hesitated, he could get killed, he could get killed, somebody else could get killed. I had to do this for them. And that is actually the bond they make there is one reason there is so much PTS or PTSD, because when they lose one of their brothers in battle, it is catastrophic psychologically to these guys. Because these are more than brothers. These are more than family members. These are people who are, it's hard to even explain how close they are. And these guys who do finally get back with them 15, 20 years later, it's boom. It's like nothing changed.
Some of the most interesting conversations you have in the book, Battlescar Ship, is talking to them about what they did at the time, 20 years ago, almost 21 years ago, including killing people. And their perspective on killing has changed. Their appreciation, my word, for the significance of what they did. But they all said, everyone in the book said, wouldn't do anything different. I was defending
That's right.
Personal.
That's right.
Wouldn't do anything different. Okay, let's get you out with this. In the epilogue, try to tell us the story about First Sergeant Hill at Camp Pendleton, the reunion.
Yeah, I was honored to be invited to go back there for a actually this the reunion was last year. The First Sergeant Hill was a memorial ceremony up on top of First Sergeant Hill. I think that was almost 2 years ago. And this shirt they gave them out to everybody, 36 names of the Marines of 3-5 who lost their lives between 2003 and 2006. We all wore those shirts and climbed to the top. And initially I said, I have arthritis in my knees and my back. And I looked at that hill and it looked like it went straight up. And then when I saw one of the Marines was making the climb with a prosthetic leg, I said, there is no way I am getting a ride up this hill. So I did it. And it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. But it was a very emotional moment. There were a lot of tears. They say, oh, military guys don't cry. But let me tell you, I saw a lot of tears up there, and it was a very emotional ceremony. They planted a cross. I will say the one thing that one quirk in this that bugged me a little bit was I walked all around this gigantic area up on the mesa on top of this hill, really a small mountain, and I couldn't find a Star of David or any other symbol. It was all crosses, which that kind of rubbed me a little bit wrong. But still, the sentiment was still, it was about them. It was about them. It was not about whether it was Jesus Christ or Moses or whatever else. It was about them and them honoring the ones they lost. And it was a very emotional experience for them and for me. And I'm so proud of the fact that I was there and so honored to have been there that I keep this shirt back there. And a lot of people who are not talking about this topic, I go, what's that shirt behind you on that thing there? So that gives me the opportunity to tell my story.
And a remarkable honor that they wanted to include you in that, which really.
I was so honored. I was so honored. Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
We're not going to subject you to 60 seconds more because this is just too important. I don't know. It's what you did is.
Well, I'll say one thing. If you were going to ask me my favorite childhood book, it was Yertle the Turtle by Dr. Seuss. And it was only years. I loved the fact that Yertle the Turtle, the dictator, fell off the giant pile afterwards and into the mud and became king of the mud. And I only discovered years later that he was a symbol of Adolf Hitler. So I feel very good about myself having loved that book as a child. All I knew was the bad guy landed in the mud.
All right, we'll take that. We'll take the bad guy laying in the mud. But here's the last question. How did your experience then and then revisiting it for this book change you?
It just a matter of degree. I already respected these guys tremendously, but I would say my respect went from an 8.5 to an 11, if we're talking about, this is Spinal Tap here. It went to 11 on the 10-point scale. I just admire them out the wazoo. It's just incredible. It's been a really fulfilling experience for me to see how well they were so eloquent and so thoughtful, and they've thought about this stuff so much. I was just amazed. These are not jarheads. Don't ever let yourself think that these are a bunch of jarheads. These guys are sharp. I probably got the cream of the crop because these were the guys who volunteered to talk to me. So these were mostly guys who had dealt with their issues and guys who knew that they could do an interview. And there was only one guy in the whole group. No, I just love this guy. But he said, they wanted me to sit around in a circle and sing Kumbaya and hold hands. That ain't fucking happening. So, but he was dealing with it. And I found him incredibly charming and funny. And he just was dealing with it in a different way. Many of them do deal with it in a different way. Some of them get professional help and some of them just deal with it the best they can by themselves and with their families and with their buddies.
Yeah, I'd be willing to bet your book, Chip, helped a lot of them. I think it was.
I hope so. That was the real goal.
Their stories, their voices, what they care about now came through so clearly. And
it helps people who read the book, too. That's always been, once I realized what these guys were going through, that was my goal.
And knowing a lot of people with PTS, I take your point. A lot of them don't like the D. I think it'd be very helpful for them to read this and see so many of them. But thank you thank you for doing it. Thank you for embedding in the first place. It was very courageous. I was like, Jamie, like, I'm in the Pentagon. I'm fine. I'm inside these walls. It's fine.
Yeah, but you helped make it happen, Tori. Thank you. You gave me the most incredible story I covered. This book would not have happened if this embedding thing hadn't happened. So
it was a great team of people that got it done. But the further away we get from it, the more insane it seems. Thank you for writing it. Thank you for being with us. Hope whatever your next adventure is, you'll come back. That'd be terrific. And everybody,
I'll be back tomorrow.
Go out and get this book. Even if you think you're not interested in the military, it really is. It is a real insight, human nature. It's wonderful. It's called Battle Scars. Go get it at your independent bookstore. We are back in a couple of weeks, people, with Mark Wish. The book is Necessary Deeds. All you need to know is murder, mayhem, revenge. It's fabulous. Claude, thank you for doing the hard work, my friend. Jamie, David, good to see you guys. David, have fun in Philly. And we'll see everybody in a couple of weeks.